This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Before it turned north and began to crawl up the coast of Florida, Hurricane Dorian unleashed a devastating barrage on the Bahamas with wind gusts over 220 miles an hour. Authorities in the Bahamas are still tallying the lives lost and assessing the damage, with large parts of Grand Bahama Island still underwater and entire communities flattened by the Category 5 storm. Florida's Bahamian community is rallying support for the islands, including Florida A&M University, which is reaching out to help students with family in the Bahamas. Chevron Jones is a Democrat. He's a state representative for the 101st District in southeastern Broward County. Chevron, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Florida A&M University student Donovan Bastian. Thank you as well, Donovan.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Chevron, I want to start with you. You've got quite a bit of family in the Bahamas. Just tell me how they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. My family is doing well. We have family all over the Bahamas. Family in Nassau, from Cat Island, from Azuma, from Freeport. And so my family in Cricket Island, they're all over, and my family is doing well. We have one family member who we were not able to locate after the storm, but after a few hours or so, we were able to locate her, and she was in Abaco Island, and we did get her to safety.
Some of the images, some of the footage we've seen that's kind of been relayed to us from the Bahamas is just, it's mind-boggling. I mean, the amount of destruction. Can you give us a sense of what your family is seeing and kind of what kind of shape their houses are in?
Absolutely. So my family that's in Nassau, their house was fine. They experienced a lot of wind damage, and they did experience a lot of rain. But my family members that were over in the other island, they have endured a total loss on their homes. Mm-hmm. But they are over in the with our family over in Nassau. When I asked my cousin how things are going over in the Bahamas, he works for the Bahamian government. The only thing that he can continue to say is that how bad everything is. He keeps saying, "Cuz, it's very bad." Mm-hmm. He understands the need of help from the states to help them get back on their feet eventually, but it's going to be a long process.
Right. Well, Donovan Bastian, let me bring you into this conversation. How's your family doing?
Well, my immediate family right now is okay. I'm still looking for the extended family and close friends.
And when did you kind of become aware that this storm was going to be pretty serious and pretty devastating for your family and friends in the Bahamas?
Well, being from the Bahamas, this isn't our first rodeo with hurricanes. But it intensified pretty quickly. I think when I started to track it, it was a Category 2 mm-hmm. storm, and it intensified basically overnight to a Category 4 or 5. When I noticed the 185-mile-per-hour winds, that's when I became fearful for my island after I noticed the 185-mile-per-hour winds.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts from them of leaving, at least temporarily, while the rebuilding effort gets going, or are they planning on staying put and sort of picking up the pieces there?
Well, my immediate family, by the grace of God, just happened to be in the 30% of the island that was not fully submerged in water.
And this is the Grand Bahamas?
Yes, Grand Bahama, Freeport, Grand Bahama.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, apparently 70% of the island was fully submerged in water, with up to 8 to 10 feet of water. So I thank God that they weren't in the 70%. But mm-hmm. It's minimal rebuilding for my immediate family right now. So it's minor damage, not complete total loss. So I thank God for that.
Yeah. And as far as kind of reaching out to friends, extended family, what's the thought there? Like, what are some of the challenges? Is it just communication? Is it getting to some of the places where other folks you know are in the Bahamas because of the destruction?
Yes, it's both. The lack of communication, the telecommunications companies back home, they're doing the best they can, but it's only so much you could do after a devastating storm like that. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who lives around the corner from my parents, and I got in contact with him, and he went to my parents' house, and that's how I communicated with my parents yesterday. But my mom, she managed the message. She managed to reach out to me this morning, so I've put my mind at ease.
Right. So, Chevron Jones, you're kind of spearheading an effort to help your family, your friends, your relatives, everybody you know in the Bahamas. Tell me a little bit about what's going on there, and you know, how big this effort is.
Absolutely. considering that I have a large part of my family that's over in the Bahamas, and my dad's side, his entire side is there, but my extended family and friends that's over there. So it's a responsibility to help all the Bahamians. We say that that the bloodline runs deep. And I'm sure Donovan knows that terminology very well, and it's because we take care of one another. And so my efforts to help my family and my friends in the Bahamas is to help all of them. That's why we're in contact with Senator Rubio and in contact with Congresswoman Wilson, in contact with all the stakeholders who could move the needle on things, to bringing people to safety and sending our relief to those individuals. So there are a lot of efforts that's taking place throughout the state of Florida, from the Panhandle all the way down to Key West, of resources that people are sending over to the Bahamas. Prime Minister Menas has made it clear of the things that most needed right now, which is water, tents, portable toilets, food, but more specifically baby food, that we tend to forget about, but they need baby food over there at the same time. Although this might be a large relief effort, I can't take all the credit for it. There are other individuals who are really moving the needle on these things. For example, people like Valencia Gunder down in Miami, who's doing a major work there, and even Consul General Mackey, who I know her hands are full with organizing to make sure all of these things get in the hands of the right people.
Is there a pretty big Bahamian Floridian community in your area, Chevron?
Absolutely. The area in which I represent, which used to be known as Carver Ranches, but is now known as West Park, was one of the places where Bahamians descended to back in the 30s, and they built their first homes there. And as you know, also in Coconut Grove, it was called Little Bahamas, is another area. I don't represent that area, but that's also a large area. But the area in which I represent, there's a large Bahamian population that's there, and those are individuals who are children of children. Of children
right.
who live in that area, and so they have deep ties to the Bahamas. When my grandfather came over from Cricket Island back in the 30s and 40s, he settled there in Carver Ranches, built the house that my grandmother, God bless her soul, her house still stands where my aunt and my cousins live right now.
Right. So this storm really kind of cuts deep for a lot of folks in Florida, and especially the folks that you represent too.
It does. I mean, and I'm sure Donovan's aware of this also, but what people don't understand is the Bahamians have a deep root in South Florida, in Miami. Bahamians helped build South Florida from Miami all the way to Fort Lauderdale. They helped put the railroads, to lead the railroads down all the way down to Key West. So, I mean, the deep roots that Bahamians have within Florida, it runs deep. And I think that's why the outpouring of support and love is coming from, is because there's this connection outside of just being a vacation spot, which I recommend anyone to go to.
Right.
But outside of all of that, there's a deep rooted connection of the Bahamas and how South Florida was built.
Right. So, Donovan, tell me a little bit about the effort at Florida A&M University, and I gather you're not the only Bahamian student there. Is there a pretty big student body that has some connection to the Bahamas and is affected by the storm?
Well, currently there are 38 Bahamian students enrolled at FAMU, and the efforts we made, well, day after the storm, I reached out to the Assistant Director of Relations and Public Affairs, Mr. Andrew Skerritt, and the Assistant Vice President of the Office of International Education, Mr. William T. Hyman, for assistance of anything that we could do to get relief efforts back home. My idea was to send out a mass email and let everyone know that we're starting a drive to get supplies such as water, like you said, the stuff we need, water, baby formula, Pampers, feminine products, any non-perishable items. Thus, we decided to stock up on those and ship them down to Fort Lauderdale and get them to the Bahamas as expeditiously as we can.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense, like, do you kind of feel like you want to be over there helping out yourself right now, Donovan?
Yes. The reason I said I couldn't just sit back and wait for anyone to do anything for my island, because it was such a helpless feeling just seeing all the cries for help and seeing the videos of the devastating construction and the horrid conditions back home. It was a gut-wrenching feeling to know that I can't do anything at the moment. Like, I cannot physically help any of my friends and family who needed assistance. So I just wanted to do any little thing I could, the smallest thing could help. Mm-hmm. So that's why I reached out to the directors of these various offices on campus to see what we can do, collaborate together to do to get the best effort we could get from the university.
So do you have a call out for other students or folks who want to help in the area of FAMU who can sort of bring some of the stuff that you're talking about, whether it's water, whether it's baby formula, or other products that that's going to be shipped down there?
Yes, I secured a storage unit, and we are sending out flyers and putting boxes in various apartment complexes and colleges on campus. So if anybody feels moved to donate anything, they can. And on the flyer is a contact for me and my colleague, Atavia Bowman. We will be collaborating, spreading this, working together to get as much relief as we can back to Freeport.
Mm-hmm. Chevron, I imagine you are probably feeling some of the same things that Donovan is, in that there's a sense of helplessness in some ways because you can't physically be there doing what you can to help.
Yeah, you can't be here physically. I do know that some of my colleagues and I are looking to fly over to Nassau over the next couple of days to take over some supplies and also to figure out how we can be of help and how we can be of help to them. The problem is, as Consul General Mackey made it clear, is that there's so many people who want to come over and help. And there are so many planes in the sky currently right now. And I spoke with Senator Rubio, who confirmed this. There's so many planes in the sky right now that it's causing confusion on what's happening. And mm-hmm. and so we I'm hoping that everyone can just wait for a green light from the Consul General to figure out how we can do this in an orderly fashion. Because what we don't want is what happened with a lot of these relief efforts, where a lot of things are collected and all these things are happening, and then those things get wasted in the warehouses and things.
Right.
And it continues to happen. Mm-hmm. Or people who are having these benefit concerts or having collecting money, where is that money going? Have you teamed up with the right organization, like the NAB Miami, which is the NASA Association of the Bahamas, mm-hmm. to make sure that those dollars get to the right hand? So I know there are a lot of people who are helping, and it's coming from a good place, but we want to make sure that stuff gets into the hands of the right people.
Right.
And lastly, I mean, like, the work that Donovan is doing, it's important. He has ties that's over there, and so he can make those connections with those people. But there are individuals who are doing things who don't have ties, who can't make connections with individuals, and they're doing it at the kindness of the heart. But at the same time, will that stuff get in the hands of the right people? How are you going to ship those things over to make sure it gets in the hands of the right people?
Right. And just on the shipping note, I mean, especially the amount of devastation. I mean, one airport completely underwater. I'm sure a lot of the ports, even if they want to send stuff over by boat, it's going to take a while to rebuild. So, as you say, Representative Jones, you want to kind of avoid that confusion. I want to ask real quick, too, about the political aspect of this. If there's been calls for perhaps temporary protected status for Bahamians if they need to get out of the islands for a little while, or some kind of visa help. Just give us a sense of what might be helpful there and what you're asking for.
I don't want people to get me wrong on what I'm about to say, but truth be told, I don't think Bahamians are looking for TPS. We love the Bahamas. We don't want to come to Bahamians don't want to overstay their welcome in Florida. Senator Rubio and I were talking about that this morning. That Bahamians, we love our country, and so they want to stay there. And truth be told, that Bahamians, they don't tend to overstay their visas here in the States. They go back. Although we do have leniency within the U.S. when it comes to relationships with the Bahamas, we're not looking for TPS. What we are looking for, we're looking for the federal government and President Trump now, because Senator Rubio and Senator Scott has already sent him the letter. We're asking that for those families who've been displaced, if the federal government can allow them to come here to the U.S. with their families until things – so they can figure out what needs to happen over in the Bahamas and how they can start get back on their feet. So that's all we're asking for, to allow them and their families to be connected with families here within the States. Because truth be told, the Bahamas is less than 100 miles away from Miami.
Right.
And so they are truly our next-door neighbors. So we should – be there for them in this time and figuring out a way how we can be of best support to them. So not TPS, but allow to suspension of visas for certain families who are here in the States just so they can connect with their families until they can get back on their feet.
Mm-hmm. All right. And it sounds like there's a sympathetic air in the likes of Senator Rubio and Scott, and so things could be moving along there. Well, Chevron Jones, Democratic State Representative for the 101st District in southeastern Broward County, and clearly hurting for the Bahamian community back in the Bahamas and doing everything you can to help. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by FAMU student Donovan Bastian, who's also working to help folks back in the Bahamas. Donovan, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, an Orlando family is packing a boatload of supplies to take to the Bahamas. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Heidi Hill is a veterinary technician at Underhill Animal Hospital in Orlando. Her family has been going to the Bahamas ever since she can remember, and now they're looking for a way to give back by packing a boatload of supplies to take over to the devastated islands. Hill says just as soon as they get the all clear from Bahamian authorities and the U.S. Coast Guard, they'll set out on the supply mission. And she says they're prepared to help ferry survivors to safety if needed. Heidi Hill, thanks for joining me.
Yes, absolutely. Happy to be here.
Heidi, you're going to be heading out to the Bahamas as part of a relief mission.
Yes.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about the mission. What are you going to be doing?
Basically, my family has been frequenting the islands of the Abacos myself for 22 years. We go 3 to 4 times a year. Our first, I guess, home base would be Grand Key, which is an island outside of the mainland. There is no airstrip. They basically get all of their supplies via boat. So basically our mission is to get every donation we can via the GoFundMe, anyone who's doing and utilizing our drop locations, anything from water to baby food, paper towels, clothes, shoes, anything that they directly need in terms of survival, canned goods. We're going to the islands as soon as it's clear and safe. I know there's kind of some controversy going on with the Coast Guard in terms of kind of postponing our mission due to safety.
Mm-hmm.
But however, as soon as it's safe to cross, we're going to be going and fully stocked. Our entire vessel, along with a couple buddy boats, are going to be traveling with us. So
mm-hmm.
anything we can do to help, anything we can bring over there.
Tell me about the boat then. How big is this boat?
This is a 45-foot Cabo. It sleeps 6 comfortably. It has a stateroom and it has a couple of bunk beds, a couch. It's very feasible for traveling over there. We were just there 3 weeks ago for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We visited 4 to 5 islands every time we go. But basically, everything from cases of water to canned foods, like I said, is going to be in every nick and crevice of our boat. So we're definitely going to be able to bring a large quantity over. And we have the center console going with us. It's a 36-foot Yellowfin. So we'll have our 45-foot and the 36 fully loaded.
How long is the trip over?
Typically, it takes us 4.5 hours if we're running, but because of the amount of supplies that we're going to be bringing over and the debris in the water as well, we're probably going to be going 10 to 15 knots just to play it safe, conserve our fuel because we need to be able to go there and back. It's an 800-gallon fuel capacity, so we're definitely going to be able to go there and back, but it's going to probably take this time about 12 hours to get there.
So you have friends living on the island? You've seen some footage?
Yeah. Since I've been going there my whole life, pretty much, I've kind of grown up, we only go 3 or 4 times a year, but, you know, Viking Lady is very known on the island. I do have friends, DJ, Brooks, Doc Masters are there, Denny, we know Rosie. Personally, we dozens of people we have that are, you know, now family to us, but we definitely want to be there for them in the time of need. I know, like I mentioned previously, there's not an airstrip there. Everything is by boat. So, and since they're off the mainland, they're kind of overlooked in terms of getting people over there, getting supplies, government aid. So as soon as it's safe to pass, we're gonna do our part.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from them, the folks you know there?
So I... Rosie, which is pretty much the manager of the entire island, his son is there. He's not there himself, but we have heard that there's been no loss of life currently, but everything
that's
is
That's got to be a huge
destroyed.
Relief, right? I mean, the footage, the images, even just the reports of the wind speed is just mind-boggling.
Everything is leveled. It's a complete state of emergency. It's total devastation for every island in the Bahamas.
So what have you heard about how they're coping in the meantime? I mean, the amount of destruction, where are
they
staying?
So that's kind of a hard question. The videos and the footage that I've seen, it's, like I said, complete devastation. Even if they did somewhat of a hurricane prep, you know, they knew the hurricane was coming, so much of it got washed away, you know, swept out to sea. So I'm not sure how they're coping. I don't know what they have left of their hurricane prep. Roofs are gone. People are, you know, outside, you know, they don't have anywhere to go. So another part of our hurricane relief is actually providing tents and tarps and, you know, somewhat of a temporary housing until, you know, further down the line in a couple of weeks where, you know, Bahamas government will be able to go and provide lumber and stuff to rebuild. But until then, they're kind of swinging it.
Mm. Have you heard from the folks you know on the island, have any of them said, I'm going to have to relocate for a while? Like,
I'm sure some of them will. We haven't had much contact. The cell phone line is down. The only communication we've had with them is via sat phone. So if they don't have a sat phone, they're not communicating. However, when we get there, we'll be able to do more assessments. We might relocate people to the mainland if they need be transported. But as of right now, I don't exactly know their living conditions or if, you know, they need to be transported elsewhere, but I will know very soon. As soon as it's safe to cross, as soon as Coast Guard allows us to get to them, we will do further assessment then.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7. We're talking to Heidi Hill. She's going to be taking part in a relief mission to the Bahamas to help out in the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian. Heidi, how long do you think you're going to be there for?
We're aiming to be there for 2 to 3 days. As soon as, like I said, it's safe to cross, we're going to go. Hopefully, Friday, might be Saturday morning at first light. It's going to take, like I said, about 12 hours to get there. As long as it takes for us to transport the goods onto the island, do medical assessment for the people, not only the people, but the animals. Our family business is Underhill Animal Hospital, so we're going to be taking over, you know, pet supplies from food, medicine, any IV fluids, basically anything to immediately help the animals in a state of emergency as well as the people. So as long as we can get there, transport the goods, provide our services for the humans and the animals, which will take, you know, a full day's work at least. So 2 to 3 days is what we're projecting.
Mm-hmm. Is there a veterinary clinic on the island?
No.
Right. So
there's
like
not even a hospital or clinic on the island. Like I said, everything, there's not even an airstrip on Grand Key. So any supplies they get is from the mainland, shipped via boats. If there's injuries, I mean, there might be someone there to offer some sort of medical aid, but they're going to have to travel if they need medical support, either to the States or a different island.
And how many of you are going over on the boat?
Right now, we have 3 captains on board, myself, and we actually have a retired Coast Guard rescue swimmer coming with us just to lend a helping hand. and do anything that he can do in terms of, you know, immediate injuries or rescuing as well. We're going to try. I know that there's gas being transported to somewhere in the Abacos, most likely West End. So gas is kind of an issue. If we need to start transporting people from Grand Key to a different island, then we'll have to utilize the gas in West End. However, that's pretty much still all up in the air. We won't know more until like we get there.
And it sounds like you could almost be a sort of a waterborne ambulance service for all you know. You just don't really know what you're going into.
Yep. We won't know until we get there.
Are you a bit worried about this trip? Kind of worried about what you'll see?
Of course I'm worried about what we'll see. I know, like I said, we've been, talked to from people on the island. There's no deaths been reported, so that's tremendous relief. However, it's a complete devastation. We've seen photos. We've seen videos. It's going to be 10 times worse when we actually get there and see it firsthand. I'm worried. I'm concerned. My heart is breaking for them, but I'm prepared, and I know what I'm getting into in terms of, you know, the complete devastation on the island. So I frequent the island. I was just there 3 weeks ago. I know it's going to not look the same. It's never going to be the same. But I'm just focusing on getting there and providing anything that I can do to help the people that I love and the island that I love. They've been through multiple hurricanes before. This one is probably the worst, one of the worst. But they're going to get through it. I have full faith in their resilience. They're going to come out strong, stronger than before. Might not be the same. The buildings are going to be different. It's completely leveled. But the people are going to be the same. They're going to be stronger. And I can't wait to get to them.
So are you looking for donations? Are you collecting stuff?
Yes. Right now, we have two drop locations. One is in Merritt Island. The other one is Underhill Animal Hospital in Orlando. They're doing great. So far, we've received anything from baby formula, diapers, cases of water, paper towels, medical equipment, first aid kits. It's doing great, but we definitely still need more donations. We do have a GoFundMe account. We're going to assess what we have right now from the donation locations, and then tomorrow we're going to start going to Walmart and Sam's Club and getting the other necessities that we need, tents, tarps, anything that anyone can donate. Definitely donate to the two drop locations. I'll give you those addresses, and then we have a GoFundMe account as well. We're going to make multiple trips. Right now, we're just focusing on getting to them, providing medical relief, first aid, and then obviously food and water, canned goods, just to make sure that they have, you know, supplies to live for the next few weeks before we can, you know, really get the barges over there with mass amounts of supplies. But they need us now, you know, they can't wait.
Heidi Hill is a veterinary tech at Underhill Animal Hospital. She's taking part in the relief mission to the Bahamas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Up next, what Hurricane Dorian did to turtle nests along the Atlantic coast. Researchers say up until now it's been a good year for green turtle nests. Could this storm set the turtle population back? Plus, how do turtles ride out hurricanes? We're talking turtles and hurricanes when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Although Florida escaped the worst of Hurricane Dorian, beaches along the Atlantic coast still took a pounding from storm surge and strong winds. And that's had an impact on turtle nests, particularly the green turtles that have been laying eggs in healthy numbers this season. But just how bad the impact will be is still an unknown. Well, Kate Mansfield is an associate professor at the University of Central Florida. She is the director of the Marine Turtle Research Group. Dr. Mansfield, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me and your interest in sea turtles.
And David Godfrey, Executive Director of the Sea Turtle Conservancy. David, thank you as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We're seeing a lot of footage of the storm surge, waves coming up and destroying some of the dunes. What have you heard or what have you seen in terms of what that's done to the nests?
My lab, we generally monitor about 47 kilometers of central Brevard County and southern Brevard County coastline. And right now, we haven't heard too much yet, I think in part because the mandatory evacuation has been in place. We have heard from a few folks that stuck it out there, and the pictures that they've sent us looks pretty much like some heavy beach erosion in some areas and sand accretion or dumping of extra sand in other areas, but we really don't have a good sense of what happened quite yet. We'll hopefully get more information in the next 24 hours.
So are there certain species that might be more affected because they're nesting at this part of the season rather than earlier or later in the season?
Yes, definitely. We have three species that are typically found nesting on our beaches. Leatherbacks start in March and they finish up usually by June or so, and most of those nests have already hatched for us, which is good. Loggerheads start April, May, and there's still a few nesting loggerheads out there, but their nest counts have really slowed down in the last few weeks. It's really the green turtles that we worry about with any of these stronger storms that happen usually late August through September and October. Those turtles typically nest until September at least, and their nests are going to be on the beach for a longer period of time, or at least into the fall, because they are late nesting animals. So we do have quite a few green turtle nests out there this year.
And what's the status of the green turtle? Are they in more danger or less danger than some of the other species you mentioned?
They've been doing fairly well. We have monitored them, in particular on the Archikar National Wildlife Refuge, which is the southern, about 20 kilometers, 13 miles of our survey area. It's pretty much the southern Brevard County section down to Sebastian Inlet and the Sebastian Inlet State Park. And just in that short 13-mile stretch, we've seen an exponential increase in nest numbers over the last about 6 to 10 years, which is good. Unfortunately, we've also had Matthew, Irma, and now Dorian. And green turtles are neat and weird in a way because they have high nesting years followed by low nesting years. It's kind of an every other cycle where the odd years, like 2017, 2019, we had really close to record number, if not record number, nests. And with Irma in 2017 and now Dorian, a lot of the nests that have been laid are likely or were heavily hit by these storms. But the status of the turtles is doing fairly well. Since they're late maturing, long-lived animals, it's slow science. We need to make sure that we're continuing to protect them into their turtle generation, which may be 25 to 35 years.
Right, because they live quite long lives.
Yes, and they don't mature at least until age 25 or 35, so they have to survive at least several decades out there before they're able to contribute back to their population.
David Godfrey, what are you hearing from folks who are part of the Sea Turtle Conservancy, similar kind of stories about what's happening on the beachfront and what the impact of this particular storm might be on those nests?
Well, similar to what Dr. Mansfield said, it's, you know, the storm is still just passing by. So most of the barrier islands were under mandatory evacuation. So our staff and folks that we work with are really just beginning to touch base, let us know they're okay. And we're hearing the same thing. There's a mixed bag of erosion in different areas. You know, we have a lot of experience, unfortunately, with these storms going by and impacting our nesting beaches in Florida for the last several years. And we anticipate the same kinds of things that you've seen with the other storms. And that is a fairly substantial amount of nests being lost to erosion. You know, that's a reality that sea turtles have evolved to deal with. And, you know, in normal circumstances, it can be sort of devastating to a particular year's worth of hatchlings. But as a population, it's not necessarily devastating, you know, at the population level.
Right.
There are lots of adults out there nesting and they're safe. You know, by and large, it's the eggs and hatchlings and only a certain portion of them that may be lost this year.
So what do the adult turtles do during a hurricane? Do they just swim out into the ocean? Do they come inshore? Like, do they kind of shelter in place? What does a turtle do in a hurricane?
Well, they're already out in the ocean. I don't know that anyone knows if there's any particular behavioral change that occurs when a hurricane is going overhead. You know, one must assume that they hunker down a little bit. It certainly, if they're in shallower waters, they may seek some shelter in deeper waters. The Sea Turtle Conservancy, coincidentally, right now is tracking a number of turtles released from the east coast of Florida. These were loggerheads that were had successfully nested, and we put satellite transmitters on them, and you know, in order to see what they're doing as part of their migrations. And several of those turtles are in the vicinity of the hurricane. One, in fact, is right off the coast of Grand Bahamas.
Wow.
And didn't seem to alter its behavior very much, even as the hurricane sat there.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, they seem to do pretty well. We're often asked, well, if the adults are generally okay and, you know, you're only losing some portion of the hatchlings in a year, what's the main problem with storms like this? And what's the, you know, the worst case scenario? And for us, it really is what we see is the behavior of people following the storm, particularly people who own beachfront property.
Yeah.
And how they deal with erosion and what they do to protect their homes. That's honestly where the long-term impact of turtles can come from.
And we can come back to that in a moment, but I just wanted to come back to you for a moment, Dr. Mansfield. Kind of incredible to think there's at least one turtle, I'm sure many more, just sitting out the storm as it really pummeled the Bahamas. What do you know about what turtles do during hurricanes?
There has been a little bit of work with some hawksbills off of Buck Island in the St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands area after Hurricane George a number of years ago. And it was kind of neat. The turtles basically just hunkered down on the bottom. They bounced around quite a bit. They were in fairly shallow waters and they're air breathers, so they do have to come to the surface to breathe. And so they would just come up to the surface every hour or so, take a quick breath and head back down and ride it out. I've also tracked a number of turtles over the years, some juvenile loggerheads out of the Chesapeake Bay that just kind of continued on their way through some storms, and even little baby yearlings in the Atlantic that have just kind of continued on their way or skirted around some of the edges of the storms while just pretty much behaving like turtles. So I think they're fairly well adapted to ride out storms. It's really their more critical life stages that occur on the nesting beaches that tend to be a little bit more at risk during these events.
And how far do they swim? Do they kind of cover quite a lot of territory in a lifespan?
They can, yes. The little babies that I've tracked offshore, some of those turtles we've tracked for upwards of 300 days and 4,000 kilometers.
Wow.
So these guys are about the size of a cereal bowl, and that's how far they can travel, in part with currents, but also on their own volition. And other life stages, it really depends upon where they may be, but they can travel very large distances in just a short period of time. So it's not unusual that these guys would be out there and migrating long distances.
So what about those beaches then? I mean, what are we thinking in terms of what happens next, things that people might be able to do to help rebuild that habitat if that's the case, or is it simply a case of hoping that the turtles will find somewhere else to nest next season if, you know, some of the beach where they might have been laying eggs has been knocked out?
A lot of times communities and or the state of Florida, sometimes with FEMA funding assistance, will come in and do immediate dune restorations and on a longer term basis, whole beach renourishment projects. Those can sometimes take a year or more to put together in terms of the permitting and the funding. But there's, you know, there are ongoing sand building and sand replenishment projects all around the state of Florida at any given time. Hundreds of millions of dollars are spent every year renourishing our beaches. And certainly the dollars and the sand are often directed towards places that have experienced erosion like this. So the rebuilding of the beaches is one of the tactics that, you know, it may be the lesser of a number of occasionally problematic things for sea turtles. Some people, rather than waiting on the sand, will attempt to get authorization to build seawalls emergency seawalls and revetments and things like that if they're very concerned about their homes. But as a sea turtle conservationist and someone, an organization like ours, and I'm sure Kate as well, who want to see these turtles do well and continue to have viable nesting habitat, any kind of hard structure is the worst thing that you can do for sea turtles and for the beach system.
And the lights come into play there too, right? I mean, I know there's been quite a bit of work to try and educate people to have lights that are sort of dim enough that they're not going to baffle them as they navigate their way around, right? So there have been some advances in getting people to maybe adapt a little more to the turtles' environment rather than the other way around.
Yes, and that works. Following the BP oil spill, there was a considerable amount of funding made available to mitigate the harms from that spill. And one of the things that you can put money into that creates a measurable benefit for sea turtles is working with beachfront property owners to convert lights to turtle-friendly lighting. And that's something our organization has been doing all around the Panhandle and the Gulf Coast of Florida, and we've been able to do a few on the East Coast as well. But it's very effective. It's, you know, saves money for the homeowner. It virtually eliminates disturbance to sea turtles. And that's definitely the kind of thing we'll have to go in and look at and see where there was turtle-friendly lighting on the East Coast of Florida that might have been damaged by this storm, and maybe work with those property owners to make sure they can replace those good lights with the right kind of lights going forward.
Right. Dr. Kate Mansfield, what are your thoughts on beach renourishment? Is that a good thing for turtles, or is it kind of engineering that isn't necessarily going to help these critters?
I second what David Godfrey said, and any sort of hard structure is definitely a no-go in my books, mainly because a seawall is something that causes erosion kind of down current. So even if you build a seawall, your neighbors may have issues as a result of that seawall, and over time there's a gradual loss of habitat. Sea turtles are really hardwired. They have very strong fidelity to their nesting beaches, and they'll come back every 2 to 3 years to lay their eggs in the same general area. So it's not like they can just easily go up to the Carolinas or Georgia if in Florida everything is a seawall and they can't nest.
Mm-hmm.
So beach renourishment is an alternative. It is obviously not an ideal alternative because there is some risk to the nesting habitat. It does change the color of the sand in some cases, or how compact the sand is. That makes it a little bit more difficult for the turtles to dig. But if you compare it to any sort of hard structure and armoring, it is hands down a more turtle-friendly approach.
Mm-hmm.
And the lab that I run, it's been going on, or the lab has been around since the late 1970s, early 1980s, and my predecessor, Dr. Llewellyn Earhart, founded the project. But he and now I and my crew, we've been monitoring the beaches in Central and South Brevard County for close to 40 years now. And so we typically do a lot of the post-renourishment monitoring for that area, and are able to, we work closely with the county and the Army Corps of Engineers and all the other agencies that are involved in both the permitting and the actual construction. So there is kind of that turtle component added into the activity that happens in association with any sort of beach renourishment. And we try to ensure that the habitat is up to turtle standards, I guess. Mm-hmm. I would still argue, and David Godfrey can chime in, that hard structures in the long run likely do more damage to the beach. And you know, you lose economic value if you don't have a beautiful sandy beach for tourists to come visit or people to travel down to Melbourne and mm-hmm. Melbourne Beach area to observe turtles nesting. I mean, that stretch of beach that we monitor is one of the most incredible nesting beaches in the Western Hemisphere for loggerheads, and we're seeing such an increase in green turtles. It's a real gem, and it's a place that has the potential for, you know, a lot of long-term, sustainable economic benefits.
Mm-hmm. David Godfrey, I'm just kind of wondering if you feel like you're winning the battle in terms of making people more aware and more turtle friendly, and or even just kind of more accepting of the turtles and understanding that maybe some of the things they would like to do on the beach, whether it's beach driving or other recreation activities, they might have to curtail those so they can allow the species that also use the beach to flourish. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, in terms of raising broad public awareness, we're definitely winning that battle. More and more, I mean, I've been doing this for over 25 years, working on sea turtles in Florida specifically. And people generally understand the issues. They know seawalls are a problem. They know sea turtle-friendly lighting is the best option. People are actively supporting turtle conservation by volunteering with all kinds of groups around the state. In Florida, you may know we have a sea turtle specialty license plate people can opt to purchase, and it's the second highest selling tag in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Only the University of Florida sells more, and we're gaining on them.
Well,
so turtles are very popular with people, but there are still ongoing battles, if you will, with decision makers and beachfront property owners to always get people to do the right thing, or at least balance the needs of people with sea turtles. Following storms like this, you often see it go the wrong way.
Finally, Kate Mansfield, what do you think the kind of outlook is? Like, how soon is it before you will know what the damage has been from Hurricane Dorian and how that green turtle population especially is doing in terms of those nests?
Well, we're hoping that we'll be able to access the beach in the next couple of days. We suspended our surveys just because the conditions deteriorated. And even prior to the storm, as of last Saturday, the tides were so high that we weren't even able to get our vehicles, our all-terrain vehicles, which we do have permits to access the beach. We weren't able to even drive portions of the beach. So we have to get out there. We have to assess whether our field station is in good shape. We need to make sure that all of our crew that lives and works out at the beach are safe and sound. And then we're going to slowly start resuming our surveys and get a much better picture of what's going on. Prior to the storm, we went out. We took pictures of all of our marked nests that were still incubating. We took pictures of our landmarks, which occur every half kilometer, so we'll have something to compare to. We share this information with the county, and they use it for whatever needs they have with regards to assessments and getting back out there and restoration activities. And we also inform the county of any properties that appear to be at risk as well. Just thinking back to Matthew and Irma, Matthew occurred during a low green turtle year, so the impact wasn't too bad. It was also, I think, in October, so it was a little bit later in the season. Irma, I think we're probably going to see something comparable to what we experienced with Irma. It was another big green turtle year. And overall, in that entire stretch of beach that we monitor, about 47 kilometers, I think we ended up losing about 29% or so of the green turtle nests that had been laid and about 14% of all of the loggerheads. So I expect something in that ballpark for that whole region. Down on the refuge, in the Archie Carr Refuge, which is really the hot spot for sea turtle nesting, during Irma, we still lost a good chunk of turtles, turtle nests down there, about 7,000 to 8,000, I think. So it was pretty impressive. The good thing is that turtles don't put all their eggs in one nest. they lay lots of nests over the course of a season. And as David Godfrey mentioned, those nesting females will be back in 2 to 3 years, and they're just riding off, the storm offshore. So turtles are kind of their nesting strategy is resilient. And the main worry is really what we as humans do and whether we do have those knee-jerk reactions to put in seawalls, to put in armoring, and or if we continue to have storm after storm after storm on these big years. 25 to 35 years down the road, we may start seeing the impacts of this.
Well, Dr. Kate Mansfield is an associate professor at the University of Central Florida. She is the director of the Marine Turtle Research Group. Dr. Mansfield, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by David Godfrey. He's the executive director of Sea Turtle Conservancy. David, thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for covering this issue. It's important.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for this week's show from Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.